Welcome to the Existential Hope Podcast, where we dive deep into the minds and visions of some of the world's most forward-thinking individuals. I'm your host, Beatrice Erkers, and I co-host this podcast along with Alison Didman. Today, we're joined by none other than David Pearce. David is a philosopher and a co-founder of the World Transhumanist Association, now known as Humanity Plus. David's work really challenges us to rethink our ethical paradigms. He advocates for the abolition of suffering in all sentient life through the use of biotechnology. And in this episode, we're going to dive a lot deeper into that. Also, for those who crave to dive deeper into the ideas and themes that we're exploring in this episode, I would recommend you head over to existentialhope.com. There, you'll find a full transcript of the conversation, a curated list of recommended resources for further exploration, and an exclusive art piece visualizing David's vision for the future. Before we dive into the conversation, a quick reminder also to sign up for the newsletter. That's where you can stay up to date with the new episodes and news and updates from the Existential Hope community. So finally, let's welcome David Pearce to the Existential Hope podcast.
Welcome everyone to Foresight Existential Hope podcast. I'm really excited to have David Pearce here. David, I've actually met you a few years ago in San Francisco. We were just reminiscing about it when we've had you on for a Foresight in-person salon to discuss some of the principles of the hedonistic imperative, and we'll get right into it, and just what positive futures could look like enabled by biotechnology and a few other different technological capabilities that we currently see advancing. So you are a British transhumanist philosopher and the co-founder of the World Transhumanist Association, which is now incorporated as Humanity Plus. And you approach ethical issues from a negative utilitarian perspective, and I'm excited to get into that. I'm not sure if it's even set up to date. And you also maintain a series of websites that are devoted to transhumanist topics. You've written the hedonistic imperative, and you self-published a few really interesting writings all around this theme of increasing our ability for hedonism using a variety of different technologies. So I'm really excited to dive into that. But perhaps let's start us off with just, I guess, a general, more like an introductory question of, could you explain a few core principles and perhaps some of your reasoning that led you to write the hedonistic imperative and what that hedonistic imperative actually is?
Thank you, Alison. Yeah, I suppose I feel a bit of an imposter at this podcast because I'm a deep-dyed negative utilitarianism, and negative utilitarianism is generally associated with depression, button pushing nihilism. And yet, yeah, here I have this vision, the hedonistic imperative. It doesn't gel with my temperament at all, but for technical reasons, I think we are going to phase out the biology of suffering throughout the living world and replace the traditional pleasure-pain axis with life animated entirely by gradients of intelligent bliss. And yeah, I suppose I can trace back the roots of my approach to the problem very deep into my life. My little ancestral namesake, aged 3 or 4, rescuing ants and worms from the garden path at home. I remember clapping my hands because I saw a blackbird was digging up a worm and I didn't want the worm to suffer, but remember feeling vaguely foolish in that at the age of 4, one couldn't anticipate how one could reprogram the global ecosystem. I remember just thinking, if the blackbird doesn't have the worm, her nestlings and the blackbird would starve. But yeah, so from an early age, very preoccupied by the problem of suffering.
Wait, just before we skip right on, could you just fill people in what negative utilitarianism actually is? Because I'm sure that some people have heard about it, but perhaps not everyone. If you want to throw in some Benatar, you're welcome to. But just to get people a little bit of an understanding of what do you mean by negative utilitarianism?
I would say negative utilitarianism is compassion systematized. Essentially, negative utilitarians believe our overriding moral obligation is to minimize and prevent suffering, but creating happiness is all very well, but we would always walk away from omelas. Now, that's another term that needs explaining. Omelas is this fictional city in the work of Ursula Le Guin, a vast city of fantastic delights, a wonderful place. Everyone has an absolutely brilliant time, But for unexplained reasons, the happiness of everyone at Omelas depends on a tormented girl, little girl in the basement. Now, if you're a classical utilitarian, it's obvious that given the amount of pleasure that exists in Omelas, yeah, this is morally fantastic. And by comparison, this little tormented girl, it's trivial. But a negative utilitarian will always walk away from Omelas. Yes, that is my core ethical belief. Arguably, it's implicit in Buddhism too. After all, Buddha is supposed to have said, and it's very plausible, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of the end of suffering. Suffering-focused ethics. And yes, this probably seems a paradox or anomaly that someone who is a negative utilitarian would entitle his online manifesto back in 1995, The Hedonistic Imperative. I did so for a number of reasons. One, it was rather crass branding, but if I'd entitled it a moral obligation to use biotechnology to minimize suffering, it would have probably sunk without a trace, whereas The Hedonistic Imperative, nod to Kant, the categorical imperative. But there are other reasons, too, in that if you're a negative utilitarian, you want all your dreams to come true, other things being equal. And so if we are prepared to use biotechnology, it's going to be possible not merely to help humans, but also to replace animal agriculture and its horrors with cultured meat, farm-free animal products. And this is much more ambitious, but also technically feasible. It's going to be possible to use, for example, CRISPR-based gene drives to reprogram nature, everything from cross-species fertility regulation, herbivorizing predators, essentially replacing the traditional pleasure-pain axis. Speaking of information-sensitive gradients of bliss, that's a bit of a mouthful. Why not just say super happiness? But preserving information sensitivity is critical. This difference between being blissful and blissed out. And realistically, the future will not consist, probably at any rate, of everyone being totally blissed out, but having a much higher hedonic range and hedonic set point. And we're going to be ratcheting up hedonic set points indefinitely. Sorry, I've introduced another technical term without defining it. What is a hedonic set point?
Yeah, let's get into it. And how do hedonic set points relate perhaps to something that some people know as the hedonic treadmill, or even to something that some people know as wireheading?
Yes. Okay, wireheading first. That's an interesting one. And this ties in with my, in a sense, life story, because in my early teens, I stumbled across wireheading or intracranial self-stimulation. This was Olds and Milner who stumbled across it back in 1954. Essentially, electrodes in what were then called the pleasure centers, there was absolutely no tolerance. The rat or the monkey or the human would happily keep on pressing hundreds, even thousands of times an hour to receive this intensely rewarding stimulus. And I was enchanted by this vision. Here was a cure for pain and depression. Why didn't we get rid of suffering by wiring everyone up the mesolimbic dopamine system? Unfortunately, I discovered that most people didn't share my enthusiasm for wireheading. I realized that it'd be necessary to explore other means. And here we come to hedonic set points and the hedonic treadmill. The so-called lottery paradox. 6 months after having a terrible accident and becoming quadriplegic or winning the national lottery, most people will have approximately reverted to their previous state of well-being or ill-being before the win or the tragedy. The central nervous system has this great web of negative feedback mechanisms that stop most people being very happy or very unhappy for long. And it's extremely fitness enhancing. And there is no evidence that on average, most people are any happier or unhappier than our ancestors on the African savannah. And this is a real problem with a lot of visions of the future, transhumanist visions, which tend to be, on the whole, extremely optimistic, is that unless we are prepared to upgrade our reward circuitry and recalibrate the hedonic treadmill, on average, our successors or our indefinitely youthful selves aren't likely to be significantly happier than we are today. Now, it's tempting to talk of abolishing the hedonic treadmill, but abolishing the hedonic treadmill would just leave us blissed out. The idea is that whether through drugs or more credibly and preferably via genome reform, we ratchet up approximate hedonic set points. So there can be, there will be bad hair days even in post-human paradise. But looking further ahead, the worst, the darkest days, the lowest lows of post-human life can be far better than today's peak experiences.
Great. Could you perhaps dive a little bit more into the aspect of pharmacology, perhaps even, genetic engineering that you already mentioned? Basically, how are these technologies perhaps crucial for getting us there? I think their early visions also contain nanotechnology to some extent. And, perhaps even how you've updated on the role of technology and kind of like bringing us to these futures since you first published the book quite some time ago.
Yeah, back in 1995, the human genome hadn't been decoded, and how on earth could one envisage actually tackling wild animal suffering? And I was reduced to invoking Eric Drexler, nanomachines in the oceans, all rather fairly vague and nonspecific. But one of the ways I updated HI is a phenomenon that at first blush sounds completely scientifically illiterate. Gene drives, synthetic gene drives, CRISPR-based gene drives, cheat the laws of Mendelian inheritance. And let's say you want to spread a benign gene through an entire free-living population of non-human animals, or even hundreds of thousands of free-living non-human animals. Let's focus on the SCN9A gene, the volume knob for pain. Suppose that having a benign version of SCN9A, SCN9A has dozens of different alleles, would normally carry a modest fitness cost to the individual. Gene drives, by cheating the laws of Mendelian inheritance, they enable one to spread a benign gene across an entire benign allele across an entire population, even if the allele in question would normally carry a fitness cost to the individual. Now, gene drives are first most likely going to be used to defeat vector-borne disease in Africa. If one can, for example, ensure that all anopheles mosquitoes born are male, one can drive the species extinct. But it's also possible to use gene drives, tunable gene drives, to regulate everything from pain sensitivity, hedonic set points, fertility, any genetically modulable trait you can think of. And this was the last and the hardest aspect of the abolitionist project in my mind, because one could see how it's possible in the case of humans to tweak our genomes and giving all prospective parents access to pre-implantation, genetic screening, counseling, and soon genome editing. And I could see how it's possible, to get rid of animal agriculture and to help large terrestrial vertebrates. But how on earth do you help small, fast-breeding rodents and organisms, deep marine environments? So that was the last leg of the abolitionist project in my own mind. The details, obviously, are horrendously complicated. And before starting to use something like gene drives in open field context, one will want to use pilot studies and self-contained artificial biospheres. But if global consensus existed for the abolition of suffering, it'd be possible to have a 100-year plan. Sadly, this is currently fanciful. It's too far outside the Overton window. We can bang the drum for this kind of vision, but it's still fairly fringe. But in the long run, yeah, I think we're going to abolish all experience below hedonic zero.
I think an interesting point about the book is that it's like outside of the Overton window in two ways. One said, you know, it proposes like a relatively ambitious vision for humanity using really ambitious technological development that not everyone may get on board with. But then also in the second version, it also includes non-human animals in the mix. And so could you share a little bit more about, you know, like what perhaps made you include non-human sentences into the hedonic imperative and, you know, perhaps make an argument for people that may not feel that obvious, perhaps at the start?
It encompassed non-humans, but the problem was that the technology just wasn't there. And as I could allude to cultured meat, in vitro meat, but it was still sci-fi. And as I touched on, I couldn't allude to gene drives. I'm personally a third-generation vegetarian vegan, so I've always been preoccupied with the problem of non-human animal suffering. But a lot of the problems seem intractable. And for example, if we are to fix the problem of wild animal suffering, we will need to tackle the problem of predation. Naively, again, it sounds completely ecologically literate, the idea of phasing out predation. Surely without predators, there would be an uncontrolled population explosion of herbivores, leading to ecological catastrophe and more suffering. But once again, yeah, one can use genome editing to genetically tweak, currently obligate carnivores. And there are some carnivores, such as dogs, that can actually lead longer, healthier lives on a vegan diet. And this is extremely counterintuitive. But in the case of cats, you need very special food. Now, personally, and I stress this would be my personal preference, I would be very happy to see predatory species non-violently to go extinct. However, most people are aghast at the thought of losing charismatic megafauna such as members of the cat family. One needs to think of technical fixes. And technical fixes are there. If we're serious about tackling the problem of predation, everything from catnip-laced cultured meat to segregation, technologies like that. Realistically, tackling the problem of wild animal suffering is not going to happen as long as we are systematically hurting, harming, killing, exploiting non-human animals as sentient as small children in factory farms and slaughterhouses. And I think that is our overriding obligation right now, given that animal agriculture is the worst source of severe, readily avoidable suffering in the world today. So why have a debate about wild animal suffering? If we don't have such a debate, a lot of time and energy resources will be spent on misguided initiatives such as rewilding or active breeding programs for big cats or something like that. And essentially, do we want a biosphere in which sentient beings hurt, harm, and kill each other? Or do we want a living world in which all sentient beings can flourish? And what would once be just utopian dreaming, I would call the book of Isaiah, the peaceable kingdom where the lion and the wolf will lie down with the lamb. We now have, or shortly have, the ability to make this happen. And particularly if one is addressing religious traditionalists, for example, I think it's very important to start with these ancient precedents. You know, it's not just a few madcap transhumanists are talking about this. It's a very ancient vision. Actually, Gautama Buddha, may all that have the life be delivered from suffering. Or Isaiah, the peaceable kingdom. But of course, neither Buddha nor the Bible go into the technical specifics. And we're now in a position to actually draw up blueprints for what a predator-free biosphere would involve. Clearly, something like cross-species fertility regulation via immunocontraception, tunable gene drives is tremendously computationally intensive. But we're not going to run out of computer power.
I think one really interesting bit about your work in general is that you take negative utilitarian assumptions, perhaps even some antinatalist assumption, especially when it comes to possibly phasing out entire species. But then you arrive at possible solutions that also, let's say, folks that have a relatively, you know, like more normal sounding or like more perhaps like more usual sounding like narrative or outlook of like more lives are on net better if they are well lived and so forth can get on board with. You know, some of the things that you're proposing are definitely outside of the open window for most of the general public, but at least you enter, like you come from a relatively negative utilitarian perspective into a transhumanist like world, which they usually don't interact very much, or at least not in a positive way. Let's put it that way. So that's what I thought was interesting. And so I'm really curious, you know, how the book was received, you know, the manifesto was received. If you think that there are like some counter arguments or like some myths that you think are just like that arise from just like not understanding, you know, what this kind of like general vision is about, or if you think that there is perhaps some counter arguments that actually have some footholds where you're like, oh, I'm not really quite sure how to figure this one out yet.
Couple of points. First, just going, it really is worth stressing that one needn't be any kind of negative utilitarian to buy into the abolition. You know, classical utilitarians can support it too. Deontologists, pluralists, religious and secular people alike. This is more, as I said, this element of personal autobiography, my personal views. In terms of Enist Comparative, I'd always assumed that my views were unpublishable because back late last century, before the World Wide Web, if you had eccentric views, essentially, yeah, you could private publishing or so-called vanity publishing, or you could declaim them on street corners. But essentially, they just couldn't be published. And as I was as excited as anyone by the idea that, hey, I could actually write and publish. And I started off with a national audience of analytic philosophers in mind, because although I'm not a professional academic, background in philosophy. Halfway through, I realized, hey, one needn't just write for analytic philosophers. One can jazz things up for a wider public. But the Hedonistic Imperative, unfortunately, it's still written. It's written in a clotted academic style. I wouldn't write in the same vein today. But the core message that essentially it's going to be possible to get rid of all experience below hedonic zero and replace it with life based on gradients of bliss, that's remained unchanged. Reception? Yeah, which I was, as I said, in those days, putting up something on the web, and then back in 1996, getting my own website. That was actually an event in those days. So I was pleasantly surprised at the feedback. Young postgrad at the London School of Economics called Nick Bostrom. I read the manifesto, filed a couple of pertinent objections, got in touch, and we set up the World Transhumanist Association. Transhumanism, that's another technical term, fairly technical. Just to define it, I define transhumanism in terms of the three supers: super intelligence, super longevity, and super happiness. And Nick, he hates negative utilitarianism, but he was fascinated by this idea that it was possible to recalibrate the hedonic treadmill and have a new motivational architecture. And together we set up the WTA. Transhumanism is a tremendously diverse, disparate movement. Although for the first decade of this century, the WTA was the overarching transhumanist organization. Essentially, the whole ecosystem is now balkanized, but the influence of transhumanist ideas has grown. I'm happy to talk about the other two supers, but my focus has been on fixing the problem of suffering and creating super happiness. Probably the most common objection still is you can't appreciate the sweet without the sour, that pleasure and pain are largely, if not wholly, relative, that a lot of people just can't really wrap their head around the possibility that life could be based entirely on gradients of bliss, because surely diminution of bliss, isn't that going to be experienced as suffering or unpleasantness? And my couple of rebuttals here. One is, it's rather tragic that we know that some people spend their whole lives essentially below hedonic zero. They suffer from chronic depression, pain. They still go through life if they've got a more or less functioning signaling system. Yeah, they never enjoy life, but their whole life is spent hedonic zero, below hedonic zero. A small, fortunate minority of people bounce their life at the other extreme. I often cite my transhumanist colleague, Anders Sandberg. If pressed, he once said, "I do have a ridiculously high hedonic set point." And he does. And there are other people, not many people, admittedly. They don't tend to be studied in the same way as depressives because they don't come to the attention of the medical authorities. But they are an existence proof, if you like, that life based entirely on information-sensitive gradients of well-being is possible. The other, this is a much more earthy refutation of the pain and pleasure and relative thesis, is lovemaking. If done, I say that because I'm a philosopher, but lovemaking, if done properly, is generically pleasurable throughout. There are peaks and there are troughs, but the troughs aren't unpleasant. They're just not as good as the peaks. Now imagine the cerebral analog of lovemaking as just everyday life with the signaling function retained. One thing to worry about when it comes to creating an entire civilization where so-called hypothymic people, temperamentally extremely optimistic without being manic, what about depressive realism? Because on a fair number of measures, people who are mild to moderately depressed, their judgment is actually superior to most people. But, and this is going to be a challenge too, but known biases can be corrected for. And if we are prepared to recalibrate the hedonic treadmill, rather than imagining that, it's not a case of some madcap transhumanist trying to impose his vision of paradise on the rest of the world. If your hedonic treadmill is recalibrated, just imagine waking up in the morning in an extremely good mood, but with your values and preferences and relationships intact. All kinds of complications, yeah, but HI isn't a case of trying to prescribe to people how they should lead their life. In practice, a world animated by gradients of bliss will be radically different. But no one need fear that by having their hedonic set point elevated, that they will somehow, kicking and screaming, be forced to give up what they love and cherish. It doesn't work that way.
Do you quickly want to also discuss how it ties in with the other two super, so if we have like super happiness, how does it tie in with super intelligence and perhaps with super longevity? And in particular, you know, from having founded the Transhumanist Association, now Humanity Plus, and having written the book, like how did these kind of like visions, you know, or at least like assumptions of a transhumanist future change since then?
Good heavens. Let's start with super longevity, radical life extension, not just adding a year or two, but essentially indefinite lifespans. The name to mention here is Aubrey de Grey, and Aubrey essentially rescued radical anti-aging research from crank alley. Aubrey is more optimistic about timescales than I am. But yeah, just as there is no fundamental law of nature that says silicon robots must grow old and perish, that they can be repaired and upgraded indefinitely, the same is true of organic robots too. And science is likely to fix the problem of aging. The question is when. And that's the critical thing. Probably most people listening will be thinking, yes, maybe science will fix the problem of aging, but I'll be dead. Which is why it's really important in terms of not making people just depressed or demoralized or uncomfortable to stress a twin-track approach. It will be fantastic if we have opt-out cryonics and opt-in cryosynergia. Cryoconics is the idea that instead of being buried or cremated, you can be suspended, ideally in optimal conditions, such as an advanced civilization, or maybe your grandchildren or great-grandchildren can reanimate you when the technology becomes available, curing whatever killed you and other enhancements too. Cryothanasia is more controversial. This is the idea that instead of waiting till you're, let's say, 95 and pretty gaga, you could be suspended. You were after being, retired, so to speak, but in optimal conditions at, let's say, the age of 75. You've still got most of your faculties. And it's very definitely, so it's likely you rather than a shadow of your former self, because, sadly, many nonagenarians, octogenarians really are shadows of their former selves. Anyway, that's the...
Yes, just to hover on this for 1 second, I feel like if we just look back, especially the opt-out on euthanasia is pretty controversial, I would guess. And, even the opt-in cryonics is still extremely controversial, even if you call it opt-in. I think that it's one thing that happened...
Opt-out cryonics, opt-in cryosynasia.
Okay, good. That way around a little bit more palatable. Okay, good. But I think in general, one interesting thing about that is to note that since back in the days, when these hopes and dreams of the transhumanist growing movement really came into being, there has definitely been a lot of progress on longevity, or at least in growing the field and making it now not perhaps as small as it used to be. There's really been a tremendous uptake, both in terms of companies founded, in terms of VCs that are now solely focusing on longevity, in terms of scientific breakthroughs made, in terms of people being interested in the field, really trying different longevity therapies and really taking this by the hand. And I think, many of those in the foster community, I'm pretty optimistic about them. But at the same time, I also still think that we will probably not make it there yet, at least people currently alive. Anyway, but if you think that, and that excludes kind of AI timelines now for a second, because that's not to overcomplicate that, we will get to that in a second. But if you think that, then chronic is obviously the next kind of point that you would get to. But I feel like even though longevity in itself has become definitely a little bit more palatable in the last, 5 to 10 years, chronics itself hasn't yet. And I feel like it requires these two very uncomfortable switches of mind. One is that you have to accept that death is probably bad, or that a good life lived is worth continuing. And then once people do that switch, then they're full into longevity mode. And then they are now on this new track where they think that we will make it. And so I think in order to take bionics even into consideration, you have to make the second even more uncomfortable switch that yes, life is worth continuing, and no, we will not make it. And so I think, I'm really curious if you have any thoughts on this, or how one could possibly help people make that switch if they feel so inclined, or anything on that avenue would be useful.
Yes, as a negative utilitarian, I support cryonics because I think it helps defang death. I'm not convinced that post-human superintelligence would really want to reanimate Darwinian malware from a bygone era. Sure, post-human superintelligence could cure whatever normally killed the patient and upgrade reward circuitry, cognitive abilities, and so on. But in what sense would this reanimated post or transhuman smart angel really be me? That said, as I said, by defanging death, so you can visit grandpa in the cryonics tank, I think, that cryonics can play a valuable role. Like you, I'm skeptical. Middle-aged and older people, at least, are going to make this transition to indefinite lifespans. For all the progress in anti-aging medicine, maximum human life expectancy has peaked under 120 years. If one discounts the most likely spurious Calment case, this woman who usurped her mother's identity for tax purpose, as it is obvious, is often cited as the longest lived. But if you ignore the Calment case, yes, currently we're not actually getting any older. But on a brighter note, if you are worried, sign up for cryonics and consider cryothanasia in jurisdictions where it would be legal. There need to be tremendous safeguards.
Yes, I think all of that, and you go into all of that. I guess we're talking about it so like in a blasé fashion. And I think if one actually considers your writings, you do go into a lot of the kind of like considerations back and forth and like safety and ethical considerations around them. So I think that while we can only tackle on the surface, you now feel that your interest is piqued, you as a listener or as a viewer, or you feel like this is absolutely terrible and super, and then I'm very much opposed to this, then I think it is worthwhile to actually go into David Pierce's longer writing on this, because you do a pretty good thorough job about going into different edge cases and so forth. And perhaps if we could just tackle the last super, and then I hand it over to Beatrice. Superintelligence thoughts, how it integrates, especially with super longevity. Like, we recently had a Moneyfold prediction market at our Vision Weekend, our annual festival, where we basically asked the question of, will human or AI intelligence solve longevity? And I think the market was on artificial intelligence solving longevity first, you know, basically AGI timelines being shorter possibly than your timelines on whether or not we can hit longevity escape velocity. Anyway, with all of that being aside, what is the super intelligence aspect perhaps in the transhumanist kind of like canon, and like how do you think it interrelates with the super happiness and the super longevity aspect of a transhumanist vision?
Tying it to super longevity, can national artificial general intelligence or artificial general super intelligence dispense with the normal scientific method, placebo controlled, double blind, crossover prospective trials? And I'm more cautious and skeptical here. And skeptical, cautious on a lot of areas. But first, what exactly is superintelligence? And transhumanists very crudely have three different conceptions of superintelligence. One envisages superintelligence as essentially transhuman and posthuman descendants, genetically rewritten, massively augmented with neurochips and the like, with narrow AI. But nonetheless, very much the continuation of Homo sapiens. That's one. I think we're a biointelligence explosion. And that is the particular vision that I regard as most credible for reasons happy to discuss. Second vision, particularly associated with Ray Kurzweil, envisages essentially a fusion of humans and our machines and technologies such as alleged mind uploading. This is the idea that your CNS could be digitally scanned and then uploaded to a less perishable substrate. And it's a very optimistic vision. But the third kind of superintelligence, a conception that originated with mathematician I.J. Goode, but developed by Eliezer Yudkowsky, Miri, and Nick Bostrom, envisages our machines as essentially superseding humans. This is this idea that there could be a runaway explosion of recursively self-improving software-based AI. And with the so-called alignment problem on this conception of superintelligence, there's no guarantee that the interests of this artificial general artificial superintelligence will be aligned with the goals and values of humans, of sentient beings. And someone like Eliezer Yudkowsky, for instance, thinks it extremely likely that within the next anything from 2 to 10 years, that sentient life on Earth is going to be wiped out. Nick Bostrom would put the assign a lower credence to this, but it's a worry. Why am I a skeptic about this kind of conception of superintelligence? I regard computers with existing architecture as cognitively crippled because they cannot solve the phenomenal binding problem. Therefore, they are non-sentient and they are never going to wake up. Now, I'm happy to discuss the binding problem if you're interested, but some people would say, well, so what? A stockfish, for example, it's not sentient, can't solve the binding problem, but it doesn't need to. It can cognitively outperform all humans at chess, and we can generalize this to all cognitive domains. But imagine if the textures of the pieces in the game of chess could subtly influence the gameplay. Now, you might say that wouldn't really be chess. And that's the point, in that consciousness has the ability, phenomenally bound consciousness has the causal functional ability to talk about itself, to manipulate itself. Humans spend a lot of our lives trying to manipulate our own conscious states, to talk about it, about them, to, in many cases, to explore altered state spaces of consciousness with psychedelics. Digital zombies can't do this. They have no conception of consciousness. They can't alter their states of mind because they have no states of mind to alter. The entire empirical realm is cognitively accessible to classical digital zombies.
You can imagine self-improvement without the conscious aspect, right? You know, some existing AI systems are already like to be capable.
In many cognitive domains, I'm absolutely bowled over by what zombie AI can do. Everything ranging from ChatGPT-4 to the many happy hours I spend with AI art programs. But we're so entranced by the apparently accelerating advance of the abilities of AI, we don't actually latch on to the limitations. And the fact that classical digital zombies have no conception of consciousness, I argue, has profound computational functional consequences. That's a controversial view. As I said, preconceptions of superintelligence, they can be subdivided into to many others, but not all transhumanists believe that sentient life is going to be completely eclipsed by machines. For what it's worth, and I'm not saying this in the spirit of someone who is temperamentally optimistic, I don't regard sentience as a mere implementation detail. I see it as the key to the plot. I confess, my heart normally sinks if someone says anything like this. I believe, essentially, that because phenomenal binding is non-classical, we are essentially quantum minds running classical world simulations that essentially, without phenomenal binding, there is no mind. Minds make organic life special. Mind is ancient. It dates to at least the late Precambrian. And as long as we keep existing computer architectures, classical Turing machines, LLMs, computers are not going to be able to wake up and explore the empirical realm. I should flag this as very controversial.
It may be your most controversial view out of all of them, especially for one, you could say that, you know, I guess like the fact that humans are, well, for one, it's controversial to say that humans may be the biological beings may be the only kind of ability to achieve consciousness, if that's correct. And then the additional one is pretty controversial that the kind of like the property of consciousness is something that makes us, you know, like superior, what makes us outcompete even on a, you know, productivity or world dominance level, non-conscious, like classical artificial AI systems. Those may definitely be your most controversial views yet.
Absolutely. I should stress that I'm a physicalist. If anyone has a theory that's inconsistent with the standard model of physics, then I think they're probably wrong. And though my views are weird, I don't have some agenda.
I guess you could imagine possibly a future system that, you know, would meet some of the physicalist conditions that could possibly be conscious, or no, never. It has to be a straight up biological system.
Non-biological quantum mind, for example. But this debate assumes that you accept that phenomenal binding is classically inexplicable. And if you say that the binding problem to a lot of people, they'll scratch their heads or ask you to remind them what the binding problem is. So realistically, let's do it. Why is it that if, as standard neuroscience suggests, that you are 86 billion odd membrane-bound neurons, a pack of classical neurons, why is it that right now you're a unified subject of experience undergoing multiple perceptual objects and having a unified self? And essentially, science on standard assumptions, does not know the answer. And one of the ways to see just how computationally, functionally powerful phenomenal binding is and why it's been so adaptive and why it's so evolved is to look at syndromes where phenomenal binding partially breaks down. Simultaneognosia, for example. Someone with simultaneognosia can only see one perceptual object at once. Or someone with integrative agnosia can't see a lion. They can see jaws and teeth and a mane, but there's no integrated percept. Or someone with acinetopsia can't perceive motion, just a line here and a line nearer and then nearer still. And this both local and global binding are tremendously computationally, functionally powerful. Unity of perception, unity of the self, which breaks down in schizophrenia. Essentially, it's phenomenal binding that allows the phenomenon of mind. And this makes us different. And just to develop this point, think of a classical Turing machine as envisaged by Alan Turing. Now, imagine replacing the ones and zeros of the program with discrete micropixels of experience. Now, then run the code, the program as before. However fast the speed of execution, however complex the code, all one has is a micro-experiential zombie. No phenomenal unity, no phenomenal binding, just patterns of mind dust, so to speak. And how one actually explains binding, this probably isn't the place for a discussion on quantum mind, but nonetheless, it's not woo. But unless you drop the binding problem, you'll find that, I've been saying is absolutely crazy.
Okay, wonderful. You know, there's a further question of, could intelligence, even before it reached some superintelligence, actually cause an existential risk to existing biological intelligences? And what to think about that, even without getting into, possible quantum mind futures that may or may not be unlocked and that could possibly propose a counterpart to our existing biologically dominating intelligences, para being conscious. But maybe we'll leave this here. I'm sure that plenty of people working on the classical AI systems, will want to chime in on this. Please do so in the comments. It will be really interesting to hear more discussion on this. Because it definitely, I think, goes quite contrary to what most people, I think, are currently worried about vis-a-vis AI systems. So it would be interesting to hear you respond to those. I will leave it at this point because I have cornered you way too long and I've hogged the mic way too long, but I need to give it up to Beatrice finally to get into some of the more existential hopey questions of our podcast. But thanks so much. I'm sure that we've covered a lot of pretty interesting and thought-provoking, probably objections-provoking ground. And I'm really curious to see what comes of it. Beatrice, you take over.
Yeah. Allison. Hello, Beatrice.
Hello. That was a rabbit hole. But it was very interesting. Yes, you're quite the unusual transhumanist. I usually use transhumanists as an example of why existential hope matters, because they're usually very excited about the future and think it can be really great. So they just want to experience it and they're willing to do a lot of work and work on minimizing existential risk. And yeah, I think for most people, they have to be very excited about the future and feel like there's hope to be willing to work on it. But as a negative utilitarian, I'm very curious and a bit nervous, I think, to hear what your hopeful vision of the future would be. But you obviously have a clear idea of what you think would make the world a better place in terms of eliminating suffering. But I'm also very curious to hear just how likely you think it is that we'll get there. But I'm going to start with asking you about, there's the term eucatastrophe. Maybe as a philosopher, you're familiar with it. It was coined by Toby Ord and Owen Cotton Barrett. No, it was coined by Tolkien, actually. But they used it in a paper called Existential Risk and Existential Hope. And so a eucatastrophe, just so everyone is on the same page, is an event that once it's happened, the expected value of the world would be much higher. So it's the opposite of a risk, a catastrophe. And so I'd be very curious to hear, do you have, what would be your eucatastrophe? Can you share a vision of existential hope for the future?
Yes, that hedonic range today is very schematically minus 10 to 0 to plus 10, where minus 10 is abject despair, agony. 0 is hedonically neutral experience, neither good nor bad. Plus 10 is orgasmic ecstasy or the most wonderful experience you've ever had. Now, mastery of our reward circuitry, understanding of the molecular signature of pure bliss, solution to the binding problem, enables us not to just, I say just, create life, let's say +5 to +15. It will be possible to have civilization, for example, but people, not just people, not so much people, but transhumans and posthumans, live their lives +90 to +100. It'd be possible to have life that is orders of magnitude richer, more wonderful than anything imaginable today. I can use these numbers, but one doesn't really know what one is talking about. And this will simply be the default condition. Now, one can speak of a civilization of the hedonic range of 90 to 100. One could also say +70 to +100, which in some sense would have a wide hedonic range. And the reason for giving this as an example is that some people worry that a civilization of super happiness would be all a bit samey and monotonous. In practice, one can have as much diversity and richness as we want. Now, I'm making a number of assumptions here. Critically, we're going to need to actually understand what is the molecular signature of pure bliss. You mentioned Toby Ord. Toby Ord describes negative utilitarianism as a devastatingly callous doctrine. But there's a difference between classical and negative utilitarians in that a negative utilitarian is happy to settle for a world animated by gradients of intelligent bliss, a tremendously rich civilization. But if you are a classical utilitarian, you are obligated to maximize the abundance of positive value in our forward light cone. And on this conception of value, the classical conception of value, really one would need to launch a so-called utilitronium shockwave, utilitronium or hedonium. This is essentially pure bliss. The conception, the reality would be inexpressibly wonderful, but the strict classical utilitarian conception involves a world as some kind of cosmic orgasm, whereas the negative utilitarian can settle for a super civilization underpinned by gradients of intelligent bliss.
Do you feel optimistic about achieving that super civilization? Do you think it's likely that we will achieve it?
Yes, I think we will. As it temperamentally, I said, reality is awful. But once we do, when we can, in a sense, control the pleasure pain axis like a graphic equalizer, we will want to ratchet it up. And most people, they may be callous, but most people aren't wantonly cruel or malicious. And once essentially the biosphere, the level of pain and pleasure is an adjustable parameter, we will essentially continue to ratchet up hedonic set points and hedonic range. And I can't see this process stopping for a very long time. For technical reasons, there will be an upper bound. It's related to the binding problem we touched on earlier. But for technical reasons, yes, I think the future is more sublime than anything we're physiologically even capable of conceiving. Am I an optimist? I worry about the multiverse. I very much hope Everett's multiverse turns out to be a mirage, in which case there are vast numbers of Everett branches in which essentially beings don't track their own genetic source code and their reward circuitry and suffering persists. But let's assume, don't ask me how, that, that some kind of one-worldism is true. Then, yes, I think it sounds like a crude technological determinism. But once we can routinely gain mastery of our reward circuitry, life is going to become sublime. It's the question of timescales. I will be very surprised if we avoid nuclear war this century, for example. But once the technology is there, who wouldn't use it? Prospective parents, for example. No depressive wants to have depressive kids. If you could choose the hedonic range of your future children, yeah, today a lot of people would settle for traditional genetic crapshoot, but once designer babies become the norm, what dial settings will most parents choose? Most parents want to have happy children, and the happy children will want to have happier children. So there is likely to be selection pressure in favor of benign alleles and allelic combinations and against some of our nastier bits of code. All kinds of unknown unknowns there. Maybe I'm wrong about classical artificial general intelligence, but yeah, it's my best guess that the future is unimaginably sublime.
That's very hopeful, I think, that, you know, that's your best guess. If to get there, do you have any sort of recommendation of where to start? I'm imagining a young listener thinking about what to do with their career right now. What would you recommend they do?
A lot would depend on their background and interests and competences. I think the biggest obstacles to the kind of scenarios I'm describing are not technical, but essentially ethical, ideological, maybe even more than ethical, ideological, simply just status quo bias. If you're comfortable in front of a camera and, you know, doing a TikTok channel or going on YouTube, you can probably do more to accelerate the biohappiness revolution than simply being a scientist. But not everyone is comfortable on camera or is wants to go down that route. And I said it, I used to recommend getting your own website. I still think it's a good thing to do. Debate in social media. Yeah, assume that you think that the problem of suffering is the most important ethical problem we face. You may not be a negative utilitarian or a Buddhist, but you think it's central. What problems to tackle? Now, in the case of animal agriculture, you can, if you're technically minded, for example, you can go down cultured meat, technologies of cultured meat. If you're more ethically, ideologically inclined, you can taking the bioethical route. I think lobbying to close all slaughterhouses, for example, by the year, let's say 2035, it sticks in the craw for me to say this, but it's the weak link in the entire apparatus of exploitation, that most people are not comfortable with slaughterhouses, even if they eat meat. And let's say one lobbies successfully, one gets involved in politics and lobbying, and this would be a tremendous blessing for all sentience if we could end animal agriculture in this way. Because if, let's say, legislation is introduced outlawing slaughterhouses by the year, let's say, 2035, essentially, it's a tremendous commercial incentive to develop cruelty-free cultured meat and animal products. And really worth stressing here is that cultured meat needn't be genetically engineered. It could be to enhance flavor and texture, but it can be completely natural. So I've gone off track for your original question. But if you think that the world's worst source of severe and readily avoidable suffering is animal agriculture, that's, I think, is the line to think about. So by all means, drop me a line if you're interested in this field, and we can explore any of your audience, we can explore different options.
But, yeah, I actually wanted to ask you next, what are you working on right now? What are you working on? Anything exciting? I think I heard you're involved with Qualia Research Institute.
Yeah, a small ecosystem has arisen of people who are, in the broad sense of the term, abolitionists. Now, the Qualia Research Institute, abolition is simply one strand of their agenda. And Andres Gomez Emelson has been the leading light there. He's a kind of abolitionist. We've worked together. He originally invited me over to Stanford when he was chair of Stanford Transhumanist Association, gave a talk on the abolitionist project. He is very much a hands-on researcher investigating radically altered states of consciousness. I think exploring radically altered states, the spaces of consciousness, is profoundly intellectually interesting, but I'm not comfortable recommending doing so until we have got our reward circuitry sorted out. But this touches on the question of superintelligence again. What exactly is superintelligence? And mature full-spectrum superintelligence will presumably have the ability to navigate millions, even billions of state spaces of consciousness as different as waking from dreaming consciousness. Whereas, I would say a classical digital computer, there's no state of consciousness to navigate. Involved with QRI, Far Out Initiative, Invincible Wellbeing, various groups on social media. There's the Hedonistic Imperative, Facebook group, the ecosystem. Obviously serve on the board of advisors of Humanity Plus, which is the successor organization to the World Transhumanist Association. Essentially, any young person has got to decide what you regard as most important.
We're running out of time, so I'm going to try to round off. I'll just ask you the last question. So the last question is, what's the best advice you ever received?
Oh, I wish I could end in something defying, but what life lesson have I learned? I quote Andy Grove, only the paranoid survive, that even in the most wonderful circumstances, convivial surroundings, we live in a dangerous Darwinian world. Yeah, be vigilant. And sorry, I would love to be giving something warm and uplifting. I sometimes sign my emails infinite bliss, and I think life could in principle be absolutely sublime. But Darwinian life I regard as sentient malware, and don't let your guard down in this world. Sorry.
Fair enough. Thank you so much for coming and discussing this. And I guess we'll say infinite bliss. That was a good one.
I'm a mathematical finitist, but yes, it's a nice way to sign out. Infinite bliss.